In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
Thousands of people want the U.S. Supreme Court to take up their cases. We'll look at one that's dominating headlines. From SDPB, today is Monday, August 18th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, remember the county court clerk from Kentucky who refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples? Kim Davis wants the nation's highest court to weigh in again on religious liberty and unlawful discrimination. Mike Thompson explains the case and its chances of making it onto the docket. Then we explore the hallways of a memory care unit in South Dakota as we learn about how spaces are designed for people with dementia and Alzheimer's, plus the basics of exercise for brain function. Ellen Kester has that story later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In 2015, a county clerk in Kentucky refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Kim Davis defied U.S. federal orders and was temporarily jailed for contempt of court. She was sued by couples she turned away. She lost in court. Now Davis is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to consider her case. She and her lawyers have also asked the court to overturn their 2015 decision that nationally recognized same-sex marriage. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He stopped by the SDPB Sioux Falls studios to help explain.
All throughout the calendar year, the court is receiving requests for writs of certiorari, people coming to the court saying, hey, you got to hear my case. So if you watch the court's docket, if you're on the website and you look at the top bar, you can click on orders of the court. And that will show you what the court is doing with regard to some of these requests for certiorari.
All right.
But you need four of the nine to issue the writ, actually. And so it takes, you got to file your petition. There's going to be a response to it. So it takes time for the court to decide.
Yeah. I read today there was like 8,000 requests.
Yeah.
So thousands of requests come before them, and they don't have that much time.
Right. An interesting thing is there are nine justices. They all have a bunch of law clerks who are lawyers, and most of them participate in what they call the certiorari pool, which means that the law clerks will examine the request for the writ. They'll prepare a little summary and then give the summary to the to their justice. But
it's like a slush pile.
Yeah, Gorsuch
and Alito. The Supreme Court slush pile.
I don't know how they do it or where they do it, but Alito and Gorsuch are the only two justices who review all the petitions themselves.
Okay.
So she filed her petition, and then that placed the burden on the plaintiffs, the same-sex couple that sued her for money. That placed the burden on them to respond to her petition. And the Supreme Court has a mechanism where you can waive your response. Just say, I don't want to respond. You can consider the petition on its own. And so that's what the plaintiffs did here. The same, these two fellows, they said, we're waiving our right to respond.
Yeah, we are not going to be locked in battle with her forever.
Right, right. And then the court then said, somebody said up there, issued an order saying, no, you are going to respond.
Oh.
And so a response is due. It was first due September 8th. Plaintiffs have asked for an extra month, so now it's due October 8th.
Okay.
So that'll be the next stage of this appeal litigation is what does the response say? And we don't know which justice asked for the response. We don't know what they're thinking, why, any of that.
Right.
They just said, no, I want a response.
So she is a county clerk in Kentucky, was supposed to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. These two men come in to get their marriage license. She refuses. She's the only person, you know, she's making the decision for the whole county. They can't just, like, go to another window.
Right.
And so they sue her. They win. A jury awards them $100,000 in damages, including, and then plus attorney fees.
Yep.
And she is taking this fundamentally, trying to get that in front of the Supreme Court, saying, I had a right under the First Amendment for my religious beliefs to be protected. But then at the very end, there's also, oh, by the way,
right,
there shouldn't be any same-sex marriage. And right, you should overturn this other case.
Hodges versus Obergefell.
Obergefell v. Hodges. So you just need to get rid of that, yep, too. So yep, let's take the first, because the main chunk of her argument is that she was wronged in this loss to the same-sex couple.
Yep. Yep.
What is she arguing exactly? That she,
she has just such a, this litigation, Hodges was decided in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
This litigation is now over 10 years old because 10 days maybe after Hodges, these two plaintiffs went in to get a marriage license. She says, no, not giving you one. Go to another county. They don't. Davis gets sued for that. There's an injunction entered against her saying that she cannot refuse to issue a license. She violates the injunction, and she's jailed. While she's in jail, then these two plaintiffs go in and get their marriage license.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
So
six days. She's in jail for 6 days for contempt of court.
Yeah.
Because she violates the injunction.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So they get their marriage license, and then they sue her for money under, we've talked about it before, under 42 United States Code Section 1983, which says that I can sue a person acting under color of state law for violating a clearly established constitutional right. So the plaintiffs argue the right to same-sex marriage clearly established by Hodges. Mm-hmm. And she is acting under color of state law. That's the only place I can get a marriage license is through the government. She's acting as the government in refusing to issue the license. Therefore, I have a 1983 claim.
Mm-hmm.
She defends against the 1983 claim but with two defenses. One is qualified immunity. That so the state of Kentucky, the county, everybody sued. Of course, the county and the state, they have sovereign immunity. They're, any lawsuit against her in her official capacity as the clerk, she's the parties are immune from that because of sovereign immunity.
Okay.
Her personal liability, though, under 1983, she could still be liable personally unless she has qualified immunity. And qualified immunity is where this notion of the clearly established constitutional right comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So qualified immunity gets a lot of press in the law enforcement area when law enforcement are sued for violating a constitutional right. So I am immune. I qualify for immunity as an individual person acting under the color of state law if the right I violate isn't clearly established.
Yeah.
So here, her argument is the right wasn't clearly established. The Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit said, no, you're wrong. The right was clearly established. You were acting under color of state law at the time you refused to issue the license. Therefore, the plaintiffs get to proceed, and the court found that the trial court, the district court, said, ruled for the plaintiffs on the liability issue, mm-hmm, saying that you've pled your case well, you win, but we got to see what a jury will give you for money. So the jury gives each of the plaintiffs $50,000 for the total of $100,000, like you said. So that's her first defense. I was going to say that's a fairly easy defense, but it really is based on the very, very settled law,
mm-hmm,
that definitely a clearly established right. And she's definitely acting under color of state law when she does it. No questions at all there. Then her other argument is it violates her First Amendment free exercise of religion right,
mm-hmm,
to have to issue those. So the argument is, and the courts say, hey, we've never had this question before, whether the government essentially, whether she as the government, not as a private person, whether, mm-hmm, she as a person acting under color of state law can use the First Amendment as a defense to a money claim, a tort claim, like 1983.
Okay.
So the courts say, no, she can't. It doesn't make sense for the government, because she's acting under color of state law, to be liable under 1983. It doesn't make sense for the government to be able to assert a free exercise of religion claim, because it would seem that that maybe is an establishment problem, too, an establishment clause problem, too. So they say, no, as an individual, you do. So, like, she cites New York Times versus Sullivan, big First Amendment case. But that was an individual versus individual. This is a lawsuit against her in her governmental, her capacity as acting under color of state law. So in that capacity, she can't assert the defense. Personally, if she was acting outside of the color of state law, she could assert the First Amendment free exercise claim as a defense. But the court says you don't get that. You don't get the First Amendment defense either. They say the guys get the guys get their money.
Yeah. So she's arguing she's not bringing a lawsuit against the government. She's not coming and saying the government is making me a governmental employee do take an action that I feel is a violation of my religion.
Absolutely. Yep.
This is a flip of that.
Right.
But she's kind of saying that a little bit. She's saying, I don't, you know, saying that she should have a right to, as an individual person working for the government, to refuse to take an action that she feels is a violation of her religion.
Right. That's what she's saying.
Okay. And she lost once.
Yep.
And now she wants, you know, she's taking it
further.
Yeah. What do we know about this Supreme Court and whether or not this is the kind of thing that they will take up? That's a ball question.
Right. They're not going to take up the qualified immunity question. It's really clear. I don't think there are Supreme Court cases that are close to on point on that First Amendment defense claim that she has. So I don't think that's a good, I don't think they're going to take that up either. In the Hodges case, it was a 5-4. The dissenters were Roberts, who's still on the court, Thomas, who's still on the court, Alito, who's still on the court, and Scalia, who's dead.
But Amy Coney Barrett is on the court.
Yep, Amy
court,
Coney
so
Barrett.
It's not
took,
without nothing, because right, she was his clerk.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Okay. So she took she took his spot, essentially, or whatever, however you want to say that. So there are at least three who would say, I would overrule.
There's that doesn't mean that this was the way they would do it.
Exactly.
There's three that would probably be amenable to overruling Hodges, but that doesn't necessarily mean that this is the way, the legal path to their hearts.
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right. That's for sure. And it would be and we've talked about precedent before, stare decisis, got to stand by decided matters.
Yeah.
Hodges is only 10 years old. The court is supposed to adhere to precedent. There are situations where they decide they don't have to. I think that would be a big player here, too, is this is precedent.
So in a lot of ways, this is kind of it's an interesting little side note, because we all read the headlines and most of us know something about this case. But really, it's probably going to be in that 8,000 pile of requests that doesn't get picked up. However, everybody remembers also, if you follow the court at all, that Justice Thomas said after the Dobbs decision, there were other pathways to overturning some of these that should be revisited. There were other cases that should be revisited.
Yep.
And so one of the reasons is that that's why we're talking about some of these things, because he specifically opened the door, bring me a case.
Yeah.
That will help me, look at this from a different way after Dobbs. And people know that just because something's been around for a hot minute doesn't mean it cannot be changed.
That's true. That's
by the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's true. We'll see if there are four votes to grant the petition for a writ.
Yeah.
But even if they do, they still need five to do anything with Hodges.
I was reading something that was saying that, like, this doesn't really meet the agenda of the current court. And I thought, well, that's an interesting phrase. Does the Supreme Court have an agenda?
I hope they don't.
Yeah.
I hope they don't.
Didn't know that I agreed with that assessment.
Yeah. They're not supposed to. I hope they don't. I don't think they
maybe do. Maybe in the thought of, like you said, there's many important things to take up. This might not be a priority to take up.
Right. Well, I don't think this is in the right legal posture to take up and to look at whether Hodges should be overruled. I just don't think this is it. If that's your plan, I don't think this is the case.
Yeah.
But it gets a lot of play because she's notorious.
Yeah. And here we are talking about it.
Yep. Yeah.
That's Mike Thompson, criminal justice associate professor at the University of Sioux Falls. We call on him when we want to understand the United States Supreme Court. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to explore how communities care for South Dakotans with dementia. That includes the locations where these patients receive care and how we design spaces for our loved ones with dementia. Deandra Sandgren is chief nursing officer at the Good Samaritan Society.
Nursing is a second career for me. And before that, when I was living in the Black Hills, I did a number of things, including work at the rally. I've worked in car sales. And that's where I was when I got called into nursing. I'd had a loved one who'd been in the hospital, and she had a couple of great nurses and a couple nurses that just, I didn't fully feel good about leaving grandma alone. And I slept two nights in one of those awful chairs and went home and told my husband, I think I need to be a nurse. So nobody else has to feel that way. Or at least, you know, the four or five people I was assigned to, if I worked in the hospital, wouldn't feel that way. And that was, oh gosh, almost 14 years ago. And then found my calling with Good Samaritan Society and just never looked back. Once I got in working in senior care, just immediately fell in love with the needs of the seniors, and it's just going to continue to grow. And I couldn't be more proud to be able to serve with Good Samaritan and here in South Dakota.
How many times does that early memory of being in the, you know, patient chair, the loved one support chair, have you remembered in your nursing career when you see somebody else coming in with a worried loved one?
Daily.
Yeah.
I'd say daily. And I try to push that through. I mean, obviously I'm not at the bedside anymore, but as I'm talking with teams throughout South Dakota and everywhere else we serve, it's a constant reminder. Caring for people in nursing, those are things we do every day. Admitting someone to one of our assisted living or memory cares or nursing home, that's something we do every day. But that is that person's first experience. And taking the time to pause and really be in the moment and listening to them and meeting people where they're at can make all the difference in making sure people feel comfortable.
So tell us a little bit, Deandra, how fast the need is growing for memory care in South Dakota.
Throughout South Dakota and nationwide, the need for memory care is growing every day. We're in the beginnings of what experts call the silver tsunami as people start to age. But what we're seeing more and more is the needs with memory care is the mind is failing. And you have instances where you have Alzheimer's dementia, but the body is still working fine. And so you see that it's really quite heartbreaking. But trying to keep a loved one at home through that can be and extremely burdensome. And it becomes where we really are excited at Good Sam that we are in a position where we can offer these memory care services in South Dakota to meet those growing needs. Just for example, over in the Black Hills, we have over 1,000 seniors on in our St. Martin's Village campus. And we just recently opened another memory care unit there to be able to serve needs in that community.
Yeah. So if, you know, you might want to keep a loved one at home because it's familiar and they're comfortable there and you want to do everything you can, you know what's coming. How do you navigate the timing of, okay, it's time to start not only planning and getting information, but then it's time to start taking action and making a transition? Like, when do you know you really need some help?
It's a great question. I've been on the side of that as both the caregiver and the family member. And my advice to people is start looking early. Because what you don't want to do is have to make a decision out of desperation and where you're going and finding somewhere that you can feel safe and confident in your loved one's care. When we did that with my grandmother, it was so hard because my grandfather was, sorry, I'm gonna get choked up. Sorry. You know, you make promises and you make commitments to people and that's hard and that's real. And as we have those conversations with families that come to Good Samaritan, and as I had those conversations with our family, no one's ever going to be able to care for your loved one the way you do. We recognize that. But sometimes when the care becomes too much, you can put your own health at risk. And That's not healthy for anybody. That's not doing your loved one a service if you're up all night, because potentially with dementia, 60% of people wander. And we've all seen those announcements of someone who has cognitive decline and dementia has wandered and left and driven away. And that's terrifying for families. We're proud to be in a position where we can provide a safe, loving, home-like environment for your loved one. Let us take on that caregiver role, and you can go back to being the daughter, the husband, the wife, and just enjoy the time you have left with that person in the little moments where they still can feel like themselves. And we design our spaces specifically to be able to bring that home-like environment in spaces where you can enjoy your loved one for as long as they are able to still interact with you in a meaningful way. And
what am I looking for when I'm selecting a memory care unit or someone who's going to take care of my loved one who has dementia or Alzheimer's?
I would say the most important thing is, as you're looking at memory cares, you want to look at a place that's well-designed that offers some cognitive stimulation. Okay. When we've taken to designing our spaces for memory care, we're really intentional. Number one, like I said, about making it feel like home. The spaces are designed with beautiful colors for tranquility and calmness, but also has home-like touches, soft pillows, soft couches. But like I mentioned before, a lot of people wander, and you don't want that to be meaningless. You want that to be intentional. So when you're looking at a memory care, what we do at Good Sam is we have like life skill stations that are set up along our walking paths. The carpet might just be a little bit different color as you're kind of meandering through an open concept space, and it leads you to a spot that might look like it was set up like a garden. And that might, where a person might only interact with that for a few minutes, it was meaningful and they could wander there. Or then they come to an area that looks like, maybe it looks like a wood shop, certainly not with super sharp tools, but where you could essentially assemble a prefab birdhouse and be able to do something that was meaningful to those people. As we set those up in our memory care, there are spots where we have things that are like universal that a lot of people enjoy, but we also keep some of them open. So if we have someone who moves in with a specific need, we can redesign those life skill space. One of my favorite ones we had a gentleman who had been a postman all of his life. Okay. And so we set up one of the life skill spaces to look like a little post office, and it was labeled, and he could go sort mail and pick up the mail and drop it off at each room. And that gave him so much meaning and purpose, because that was his routine, was to do that. And that's just one of the things that we train our teams to do, to really find what's meaningful. So I would say first, look at how the space is designed. But then second, as you're visiting with the team members, how do they talk about the training that they do for their staff? How do they talk about creating person-centered environments that will stimulate your loved ones, and in addition to keeping them safe?
Yeah. What about outdoor spaces? How important are natural spaces? And then how do you keep people safe in outdoor spaces?
You know, growing up in South Dakota, I think there is nothing more beautiful than some of the outdoor spaces that we have around here. And as we've designed those spaces, like at Sam, we've been really intentional. So our outdoor spaces are, of course, gated to keep people safe. But you have greenery that's built in there. You have native South Dakota grasses that might be growing, or, you know, a lovely little patch of past flowers where somebody can stop and interact, literally smell the flowers, and have benches that are along the way for sitting, and little spots where people can stop and interact. We even have spaces where we've created like art, movable art on the walls, mm-hmm. of the fences. So you could stop and interact and move the butterflies around on the wall there. It's quite unique. I think one of the most interesting places as we get ready, I don't know if you've heard about Founders Crossing. That's our new location going up on the east side of Sioux Falls. Founders Crossing, really, we've made that as such that the outdoor space, it blends in with what the outdoor spaces are on the rest of the campus. So in that area, you've got independent living, independent senior living, assisted living, memory care, and then skilled nursing all on one campus. Okay. Let's say you and your spouse moved into one of our twin homes, and then you find that your partner's needing memory care. A lot of what you'll see in the elements of design through the building relate the same, and that includes the outdoor spaces.
Tell me a little bit about You mentioned, I've been thinking about what you said. We understand that loved ones take the best care of their family members. But that might not be the case because we might not be equipped to take care of someone with these needs. Can someone actually improve cognitively in memory care? What does that look like? Or is it a steady decline always?
That's a really tough question. And I wish that I would say, I think that's a million-dollar question every expert would love to answer. What we can do in memory care, because of some of the things that we can employ, we can maybe slow it down. I don't know that we can stop it altogether, but having meaningful stimulation is key to slowing the decline. Having access to people who are trained to make sure that people take the medications they're prescribed properly. Sometimes people don't want to take their meds. Sometimes people don't want to eat, and we have to get creative with those things in a way that doesn't show frustration, and that can be sometimes hard for family caregivers. So that all makes a difference in slowing progression. But there will be a steady decline if you've been diagnosed with dementia or Alzheimer's, although it might ease. I think our staff training in that space makes the huge difference. Staff are trained to really trying to reduce the frustration for residents. In another example, we'll see this a lot where someone will stand at the window and, oh, I'm waiting here for my husband. But we know that he's passed 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And saying, and that can be frustrated. I've had that situation. You're at home and saying, no, they're not here. Remember, he passed. And then you're just breaking that person's heart over and over again. But our staff are trained to say things like, oh goodness, well, I think there was some construction. How about you come with me and we'll go set the table so he's ready to go. And then saying things like, you know, I'm planning a vacation with my husband. Where's the best vacation you and your husband ever took? And really moving into that reminiscing. Sure. It's not so much changing the subject, but there's no need for, we live in the moment with where that person is in their dementia journey. And that makes a difference in helping them feel meaningful versus telling somebody over and over, no, that's not right. Or trying to reorient them to the present. That's really a very ancient view of how to treat dementia.
Yeah. I'm wondering if there are things that we learned during the pandemic or ways that we haven't quite recovered from the pandemic that we're still coming back from. Were there lessons from that time that have applied to memory care?
Absolutely. There are. I think as we thought about how to approach things in memory care, during that time, we really had to become the family for everyone in our care because visitors weren't allowed for some time. One of the things we looked at was what would that meaningful activity look like and how do you interact with technology? Because that's not something people think of with memory care. So sure, we were doing FaceTime and video chats like that so people could see their family and their grandkids. But one of the coolest things we've put into place in our centers now is we've been investing in Tovertoffles, which is a tabletop game that it's purposeful play that allows people to interact with any tabletop surface. It projects games on there and you can load a game that's right for that resident, but it gets people moving. It can help them. They might reach across the table to touch the fish that it looks like is showing up on the table. It creates laughter and ways to engage versus, you know, I love watching Gunsmoke as much as the next person in a memory care unit, but parking in front of the TV isn't good for anybody, whether you have cognitive decline or not. So finding these more interactive things, I think that's one of the key takeaways we took away from COVID was learning how to use technology to engage with our memory care residents.
Yeah. How about staffing issues? Do you still have challenges with those?
I would love to say that we don't have any staffing issues, but I would say the workforce is hard no matter what industry you're in South Dakota.
Yeah.
The beautiful thing that we're seeing is the staff that work in our memory care units and our nursing homes, man, they love it. They're just committed to those residents. They show up every day wanting to learn more. We recently invested in some new training opportunities. And so we'd put some groups through that. And the very next day we got a call from this one CNA and she's like, you know, I wasn't quite sure about this stuff you were telling me, but I tried it on this gal. She needs two person assist. But when I tried these new training methods, she took my hand, she got up, she got dressed. And so I think where I'd love to say that, no, there's not challenges, but it doesn't feel like a challenge because the people we have working in these areas are so committed to those in our care. They they pull together as a team to make sure everyone gets what they need.
Yeah, there's a tenderness to this work. There's a professionalism and a skill for sure, but also a patience and tenderness that everyone has to bring along. That stands out.
Tenderness is the perfect word for it. Yes.
Yeah. Anything else that you want to let people know about, one of the popular questions or myths that you want to dispel about memory care, especially when it comes to navigating the spaces and understanding how things are designed?
I think what I would say is, you know, a lot of times people think that memory care means, oh, I've taken them and they're just there and that's the end. And no, there can be so much meaningful life for people in memory care. There can still be going home for Sunday dinners, if that's what makes sense, and then coming back to the memory care for sleep and rest and medications and things like that. But we want our families to be engaged. We want folks to come and interact and enjoy the spaces with their loved ones. I think that's probably the biggest myth is, you know, though it sounds terrible, but, you know, we're putting somebody in a home and that's not it. We're making a home for someone that really connects for them to be able to live their most valuable quality of life for the time that they have and in the phase of life that they're in now. And we just really want to engage families in that process.
That's Deandra Sandgren, Chief Nursing Officer at the Good Samaritan Society. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Neurocentric training uses exercise centered on your brain. It's a new approach to dealing with flexibility, body aches, brain fog, and more. Jan McGrath is a neurocentric trainer at Pilates Whole Body in Rapid City, and she spoke with SDPB's Ellen Kester.
It's just brain exercises, kind of like exercises for your biceps, but specifically targeted for your brain.
Is it crosswords then, or Sudoku?
So, you know, a lot of people think of brain puzzles like Sudoku or crossword puzzles, but here, neurocentric exercises are very specific and targeted. If you can think of your brain that as the control center, as the organ that runs the whole show. So I'll give you an example. If, let's say, things are getting a little foggy, you've experienced tight joints, tired eyes, or feeling a little wobbly or fatigued or clumsy, well, guess what? Those are signals from your brain telling you that it needs upregulation, that it needs to receive better and clear signals so that it can function and move you optimally. Sometimes I think of it kind of like a GPS on your cell phone. If you have bad signals, guess what? You're not getting from A to B, right? Well, same thing with your brain. If those signals to your brain are not clear and sharp, you're not going to move. You're going to be more tentative. It's like walking in the dark. You're going to be a little apprehensive. And so those examples where I said tired eyes, wobbly, feeling fatigued, clumsy, those are signals to you. That's an output sent from your brain to say, hey, I need clearer signals. And that's where neurocentric, brain-specific exercises will help.
So there's like a disconnect between your mind and your body almost?
That's absolutely a great analogy, Ellen. I think of our brain kind of like, you know, an operating system, a computer operating system. And neurocentric exercises are running updates and fixing bugs so your system runs faster, smoother, and with fewer crashes. So instead of just strengthening the hardware, like your muscles and joints, I am going to upgrade the software that controls it all. Your brain.
Okay, so if someone comes to you and say they have balance issues,
mm-hmm.
How would you then come up with an exercise to help them with that?
Absolutely. So here, what's so wonderful about this approach is that I am going to assess, test, and reassess. There is no guesswork. So you come in, balance issues. The first thing I'm going to do is just have you do a functional movement. Let's have you just raise your arm like you have a question. And I'm just going to see where your range of motion and you, the person, also are checking to see where your arm is going to extend. Then I'm going to then do a neurocentric exercise. So what does that look like? It could be an eye exercise, like having you fix gaze on something and then slowly rotating your head while your eyes are gazing at the object. It could be something where I have you do something like, let's say, a vestibular drill, like a balance drill. So you're going to just have your head move really quick to your left and then slowly come back to center line. Some of these exercises are very simple when guided with a certified neurocentric trainer like myself. And then guess what? After we have done those exercises, then we reassess to determine if your brain liked it or not. So this is what I mean by there is no guesswork, because in real time, at the speed of your nervous system, you're going to know, and I'm going to know, if your brain liked it or did not like it. And it's all in real time. And 9 times out of 10, when I work with clients, I will know immediately. We will change and pivot and find the exercise that your brain likes that will help improve your balance.
So how do you know if a brain liked an exercise?
Well, just that example, what I said about raising your arm, right? Mm-hmm. That was my baseline. So that's just a functional movement that really is a brain function assessment. Range of motion, movement is really an output from the brain. After the eye or vestibular balance drill that I just mentioned, then I'm going to have you raise your arm once again. And 9 times out of 10, your range of motion will increase. And when that range of motion has increased, that tells me that I've upregulated your brain and your brain liked it.
Okay, so there's a little bit of a disconnect for me right now. Okay. I'm hearing that you said you raise your arm. That's the baseline.
Yes.
And then the exercises are kind of eye-based.
Eye, ear, and proprioceptive. So I use the eye because it's the most people can understand that. So if I was to ask Ellen right now to take her arm and raise it to shoulder height, take your right arm to shoulder height, and then I want you to fix your gaze at your thumbnail, just your thumbnail, okay? Stare at that thumbnail. And you're not going to move your eyes from the focusing on that thumbnail. And from that midline, you're going to slowly turn your head to your left and making sure both eyes are still looking at that thumbnail, take a breath, and slowly come back to your midline. And you're going to repeat that. And ideally, you should be able to do about 8 to 10 reps. And I, as a certified neurocentric trainer, am going to look at your body because I have a developed eye to see if your brain likes 8 reps or does not like 8 reps, okay? Mm-hmm. And then after that, I'm just going to ask you just to relax and then raise your arm again, okay? And so the raising of the arm, really, Ellen, doesn't matter. It could be raising your knee. It could be having you rotate to one side, any functional movement. If Ellen has any back aches right now, I would use your pain as your baseline assessment. Do you follow me? And all of that just tells me today, this moment, where Ellen's brain is at. And it's very personalized. I baseline, I test, and retest. And then we cycle through until we get rid of the stiffness, we get rid of the pain, we get rid of the small range of motion, whatever it is that Ellen wants to do. Again, if we recognize this one big concept, neuroplasticity, your brain is plastic. Ellen, and I are practicing applied neurology whether we like it or not. Neuroplasticity is simply that your brain is always going to reorganize itself. And it doesn't matter your age. And neuroplasticity is neither good or bad. But what we want to do is intentionally harness the power of neuroplasticity for our good, right? Mm-hmm. And typically we think of brain health when we're in our golden years, but I want people to think of it now, because just like you would work out your bicep and do some sort of general fitness, you would want to do the same with your brain, especially if you want the quickest, fastest change because the fastest fixes start above the neck, your brain.
So what comes to mind for me with neuroplasticity is like the old saying, you can't teach a dog new tricks, but it sounds
No. Yeah, so that was the old school. And mm-hmm. The old school where you believed that, neuroscientists believed that there were localization, so parts of your brains for specific functions. So if you had an auto accident and your parietal lobe, that back portion of your brain, was damaged, then your ability to sense where you are and so forth is gone. Not true. In the last 25 years, neuroscientists have recognized the power of neuroplasticity. So in other words, same example, auto accident, parietal lobe damaged, guess what? We can, using neurocentric exercise, hijack that area that's kind of like dead and damaged to retrain the brain to regain sensory and understanding where you are. Parietal lobe, one of its function is just to have you understand where you are in space. So it's not you can't change your old habits. You can create new habits and new neural pathways.
When you were talking about raising your arm, looking at your thumbnail, moving your head, I was sitting at my studio doing that. Like, I didn't break out into sweat or anything. Is that pretty normal for your classes?
Absolutely. Because here's the thing. If we can remember that the brain is the control center, it controls all. And mm-hmm. if you recognize that, then any of your movements that if you're going to go and do some weights, if you're going to take a jog where you are going to sweat, you are probably going to notice that your movement quality is better. You're going to be more confident because really what you're trying to do is provide clear signals for your brain so that your brain feels safe. And when your brain feels safe, then your body is going to move. Because the number one thing your brain cares about moment by moment is not helping Ellen move from back pain or help her to be more productive. Ellen's brain only cares about one thing, survival. And so if the brain believes there is any threat is going to cause you to freeze up and not move. And so earlier when I gave you those examples about tight joints, tired eyes, or feeling wobbly, that is your brain sending an output telling you that I'm in protection mode, I feel threatened, whereby I am not going to help you move. I'm going to put some pain out there. It's an output. I'm going to send you some foggy eye signals, tired eyes.
You said that when you get these signals that something's wonky, mm-hmm. it's because the brain is under threat.
Correct.
How, in what ways would it be under threat? Is it just daily stress?
Well, that goes into a whole topic of pain science. We often think of pain as a local event. So I hit my knee, I have a knee boo-boo, and maybe that boo-boo is pretty serious. I'm going to go to PT, and they're probably going to give me some local knee joint exercises to help relieve the pain and increase mobility. Pretty normal, right? Mm-hmm. That's the traditional approach. But from a neurocentric brain first approach, I look at it not from local, but global. So now I say, ooh, the knee, it hurts. That is an output from the brain that's sent to that area that's basically causing me to change my behavior. And so in order to fix the knee pain, I'm not just going to do local knee joint exercises or knee stretches. I'm going to do something like what I talked to you earlier, a gaze fixation exercise where Ellen was looking at her thumbnail, and I'm going to improve the signals, improve the neural pathways, whereby the brain is no longer under threat, and when it is no longer under threat, pain is reduced and relieved in that knee.
I'm still very stuck on the raising your arm, looking at your thumbnail. Can you give me another example of a neurocentric drill to do?
Sure. Okay, so what you can do is instead of one thumb, okay, I'm going to ask you to raise both right arm and left arm and then look at your thumbnails, okay? So your thumbs are up, your fingers, the rest of your fingers are curled, okay? And your arms are at shoulder height.
Okay.
And so before you do this, I actually need you to do a baseline exercise. Remember I said I test and retest. So another thing you can do is do a range of motion. So if you were to stand up, I would stand up, but then I don't think that Mike is going to follow me. If you were to stand up and bring your hands together and kind of point your finger, kind of like a Charlie's Angels pose, okay? Freeze. Okay. And now you're going to stand so that your feet are hip distance apart, your arms are stacked right above your hips, and you're going to inhale for me, you're pointed at center line, and then exhale, just do a slight rotation to the side to comfort, and then take a breath, and then return back to center line. Now inhale again, and then exhale, slowly rotate to comfort. So you're not going to push yourself. You just want to bring yourself to comfort, okay? So I'm seated, and I'm kind of doing the same thing. Maintaining my arms at shoulder height. Relax. I'm not straining myself as I rotate left and right. So try to take a snapshot of where Ellen's rotation is, how far you were able to go to your left and how far you were able to go to your right. Remember that.
Okay.
So now let's go ahead and do the neuro drill. Let's see if we can increase Ellen's range of motion. Once again, we're going to take those thumbs up and right and left is pointing up thumbs and arm at shoulder height. Now I'm going to slowly spread those thumbs a little bit beyond shoulder distance. And now I'm going to stare at one of my thumbnails. And from that, I'm going to jump my eye from left to right, thumbnails. Only staring at your thumbnails. Do that with me for 8, 7, keep breathing, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. And then relax, okay?
Okay.
So let's reassess. So back into that Charlie's Angels pose where you have your hands together, you've got that finger pointed forward like a gun, and now you're going to inhale again, and then exhale, see if your rotation has increased to the left, and then come back to center line, range of motion has definitely increased, inhale here, exhale, slowly rotate to the other side, okay? And you're just going to do that a few times, and again, you are going to see before your eyes if your brain liked it or not. 9 times out of 10, like I said, your range of motion will increase. And this is not just about range of motion. This is evidence for me to see if your brain function has upregulated or not. Obviously, we're doing this in a studio environment. I'm not seeing you. I don't know what the client is doing. So when I see them face to face, whether virtual or in person, I have I'm watching, like I said, I have a developed eye to see what I'm looking for. And there, while the exercise is easy, there's many ways for it to go wrong. And this is why, if, for example, some of your listeners have done this and said, gee whiz, nothing changed. Maybe your brain didn't like it, or more than likely, I'm going to take a guess, more than likely the controlled environment wasn't purely controlled.
That's Jan McGrath talking to SDPB's Ellen Kester. McGrath is a neurocentric trainer at Pilates Whole Body in Rapid City. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. I am your host, Lori Walsh, from all of us here at SDPB. Thank you for listening.